Hey guys, we produce this podcast for no other reason than to have a positive impact on the lives of you guys, the listeners, by sharing the stories and lessons of some incredible business owners. If you'd like to support our show, please head to Apple Podcasts or Spotify, rate us 5 stars and leave a review. Your review would be greatly appreciated and keeps us going. And now back to the show. Hello, legends. Today, I catch up with Cub member Sean Quarters, founding partner of Hatch Private Capital, an AFSL licensed business that provides capital and full service corporate advisory to businesses that have global scalability. Sean is one of Australia's leading minds in private equity and experts in company due diligence. We discuss the keys to raising capital and how founders should manage investors, the importance of assembling and utilizing an advisory board, and the importance on focusing on key development milestones that lead you to your final destination as a business. Sean is a friend, supporter, and mentor of mine. Enjoy the show. Do you remember, first of all, so nice to see you. I haven't seen you in a long time.
Daniel, great to see you, mate.
I know, but I was just about to say, do you remember you were probably the first person, I actually think you were the first person to ever step foot into a Cub, this club, which has now just become our podcast studio. But
I had to get my shoes polished after I visited.
Yes.
There was dust all over the floor.
It was a construction site.
It was.
And remember, I went and pulled you out like a, I can't remember, it was a plastic chair or, and remember I sat 2 plastic chairs in the like what became the entertainment lounge and event area.
Yeah.
And we just had a meeting literally in the dust.
You were telling me about all the fine wines you were going to stock in here.
Was I? That's weird because I know nothing about wine, so that shows you I was already trying to sell.
Yeah, you were, mate.
But, you know, back then, Cub was, the idea of Cub was more like a young entrepreneurial thing. And remember, we were looking for like advisors and mentors. And I was talking to you about that. Then obviously Cub changed and
you've pivoted well.
Yeah. Well,
should be really proud of what you've done.
No, I appreciate that. Well, anyway, I'm so excited to have you here because you're, I guess, what would you say, an expert in private capital, investing.
Problem solving.
Okay, talk more about that.
Yeah. So I think my career, I'm an accountant, right? So that explains to the listeners the way I think. So it always does come down to a lot of those metrics that the discipline of an accounting degree and thinking you can only manage what you measure. So I think in my career, mostly I've been working with entrepreneurial families and families, I haven't met a functional one yet. Right. So I think the more money you have, the more success you have, the more dysfunctional you become. It's just a funny story. But, more and more, I think families are looking for just like that trusted advice and because things always go astray. There's always a problem, and thinking, how do I actually work with someone that's not trying to sell me something is a really difficult problem. So I think in my career, I've always been there being a very relationship focused person and thinking, you know, like what's a long-term outcome here? And my lens has always been, what's a long-term solution? And, you know, how do these people navigate through these problems? And I think I've seen it all, like you never know whether it's financial markets, it's a death in the family, you know, a new competitor, just, you know, a dying business, whatever it is. I've just had a lot of exposure to those issues and developed a lot of insights along the way.
And so to be clear, so you started your career as an accountant. As an accountant, were you then assisting family offices and wealthy families to invest their money, or did you get into private wealth, private capital, and then start doing that?
Yeah, it's a really, really, really funny question, that one. So I think mostly, right, there are two types of families. You have like old wealth and people are really, really comfortable in the hands of a private bank and managing money and they're very sophisticated around it. But I think in Australia and particularly in Asia, and we're seeing more of these families here, it's about new wealth when people make money and their experience is whether it's been in real estate or a good old-fashioned industrial business of some kind. When they make money, they and the more you've got, the bigger of sales target you've got on your forehead. So a lot of it was actually just helping people answer the question about how do I go about diversifying my investments and how do I approach that? So quite often I would be tasked with sitting with a family and going up and interviewing everyone from Credit Suisse to JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley and everyone in between. And you start seeing, what I was starting to seeing was just a lot of the same sort of solutions that way. And like when you're an entrepreneurial family and you think, right, the wealth is the business and the business is the wealth, and then you start making these passive investments, it's pretty damn boring, Daniel. It's just pretty damn boring for them. So then they start thinking, well, maybe I've got an interest. And this is a classic one. So I just met with a Singaporean billionaire, second generation, just this morning, right? And they're in real estate. And he's going, I've got a passion for healthcare. And he's asking me, how do I do due diligence on healthcare? He's going, how do you know if there's this science? How do you do it? And I think that's when it became sort of about money and doing this, everything keeps coming back to these are the questions families were posing to me about how do I do it? How do I put my money? Where do I put it? You know, what are my options if I want to do something more active? How do I structure it? You know, what are the tax consequences of all that? And it's every conversation.
So basically, how do I make money, more money from my money and do it through businesses, not passive investments?
Yeah, I think, look, personally, I love the families that think that way, and it might be the money making more money, but it might be the money, you know, working for better good. You know, I've done a lot of work in philanthropy and working with families that are saying, like, you know, we want to discover a new sense of DNA through giving and being more involved in the community, you know, because we've got more money than we can spend. You know, but I think, you know, coming back to the earlier question around how the business sort of evolved from all of that is again, I think, I mean, I started to make some investments myself and saying, hey, there's a good business here in investing this way if you've got the right skill set to due diligence investments properly and know how you develop the strategy and follow through on it, because there's lots of good ideas, but you know, my friend, you've pivoted in business as well, right? It's how you actually execute and how you pivot in those tough moments. And so that's just like where I've been over a long period of time, and that's kind of like what I still really enjoy, and my business has evolved to be able to help people just around, again, that basic problem solving.
It's funny because I've seen it myself so many times. When someone makes money, particularly normally for the first time, and so they have success in whatever their business is, might be a cleaning company, but they sell it for $40 million or whatever they sell it for. All of a sudden, they feel, I've seen it happen, they feel like a business expert, and they go and they invest in all these different startups and companies and you know, random investments that they, I don't know why they do it, to be honest, but I've seen it over and over and over again, at Cub even. Yeah. Even from the start, and they end up broke. That's what happens most times. Making money is actually harder than keeping money.
Yeah.
And people don't think about that because everyone, like, I mean, 99% of people need to make more money. But then once you have the money, it's like, oh shit, how do I make sure I keep it, you know? And then everyone's come to try to take it off you. People are asking you, oh, can you invest in my company now? Family members are saying, oh, you know, I really need this. Can you pay for my renovation? You know, and you have all this stuff going on and, you know, you're keeping, you can see it, especially if they're young males. I've seen it so many times. They've got to keep their kind of ego, like they want to prop themselves up. Yep, I can do that. Yep, I'm an investor.
It's the cocktail party talk, right?
Yeah, and it just, it flatlines them.
Yeah, yeah.
So you prevent that.
Yeah, I think I reference that cocktail party talk and I say to people, let them talk to about all the ideas and you introduce me and I'm the guy that says no.
Okay, right? You make sure the ideas are great ones.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's very, very hard. I mean, Daniel, I literally see like up to five new deals a day. And, you know, I've got a really significant network around me that I've built over the years. And people come to you with a real passion and they say, this is a really, really good idea. And at face value, when you look at it, it gets really exciting. And some of it, you know, make your skin tingle, you know, like, and some of them I wish I could access myself, right? Like, so a good mate, he's really long on a new, as an example, he's really long on a new drug being developed in Israel that fast metabolizes alcohol. So, you know, you can go and drink a bottle of wine, take the tablet and drive home. And it sounds really, really interesting, right? And it safely does it. Yeah, so it's just really interesting. But yeah, I know that's what I thought, right? Straight away, right? Give me it. But then when you actually lift the hood and you come into it, it's all the same usual problems. You find what's the history of the company, how long have they been beating the drum? You know, what are all the historic problems in there when you lift the hood? It's the typical thing of when you do that due diligence, you find, you know, all the skeletons in the closet. And it's very few. It's 1 in 100 that survive that scrutiny.
And so what is your due diligence process? Well, obviously this kind of brief highlight of it.
Yeah. So look, I always start, number one is with what's the commercial opportunity? So if you see something in fintech, you've got to say, who do I know in the banking sector in a senior role? And can they just actually validate this? Because quite often you find that in validating the technology and speaking to someone like that, they'll say, oh yeah, we've seen that product in the market. There were 3 competitors you're not even aware of. So I always start with, who do I know in the industry that's a veteran that knows the space really well, and just ask them some questions. So I'll start with a hypothetical. If they give me the reaction they like it and it's really hot, I'll then move into the next stage of due diligence. And that really entails everything. It's a big laundry list of everything operational, financially and legally. Like to start with, I've learned, right, start with the low-hanging fruit on this, right? Say, give me the last tax return, give me a last set of financial statements. If they can't produce them, it's a red flag, right? So there's always some low-hanging fruit there. So I typically start with like a financial model or a forecast. And let me tell you, every single business I see and they show you the financial model, it will show, right, in 5 years' time, they're going to have $100 million in the bank. You know, it's going to be a killer business. But it's just so unbelievable. It's just not right. And again, I explained I'm an accountant, right? So you go back and you kind of know, after working with startups and knowing how tough it is and what a proper 5-10 year journey looks like, you can look at it and you can just smell the shit straight away. It's just like instinct. You go, it's not going to be it. But mostly we reject a deal. If someone shows me that deal and it's got all this, you know, blue sky nonsense in it, I'll say no straight away.
What do you mean by blue sky nonsense? Like, by this date, we're going to be this, and it's just too unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, look, I think if I give an example, right, we might say, hey, And I think a lot of, you know, the Cub community are in like SaaS, you know, products as being an example. And you can have a look at the opportunity in the market and you can kind of go, we think there's an opportunity to bring on 100,000 customers or 500 big B2B customers. And that's the market potential. And this is the type of revenue that they'll be giving us each. And they'll just build a financial model to go, we're just going to keep adding to that one by one or dozen by dozen every month without realizing the reality of running a sales force and the conversion time it takes, right? So, you know, launching new products too yourself, you know, in the sector, quite often you start and you need to get a prototype out there. You need to get, a beta product out there and people start testing it. And you're running all your corporate overhead, you're running your product development team, you're running a sales force trying to get it out there, and most businesses fail because they can't fund their growth in that moment. And when you're looking at this modeling, they're kind of showing, oh, we're just going to be selling and selling and selling, there's going to be more money in the bank to fund our growth. But you just stretch that conversion time out from 1 month to 3 months to 6 months, and you show the financial gap that you need to plug just to survive, to keep the doors open. Right.
So would you rather a company come to you with more realistic figures, or would you rather a company come to you with realistic figures or with scenario, like a sensitivity report, like scenario A, scenario B and scenario C?
Yeah, good. I mean, there's like the typical like worst case, base case, you know, best case type,
yeah,
forecasting,
that's what I did.
Right? You know,
yeah.
Like, and you have a look at that. But, you know, I think when I'm looking at it's a bit different in different circumstances. I I kind of look at it in the journey of a business too, and from a startup and the type of investors you're going to attract as well, right? So I'll look at it in, you know, the with a business concept thing here, like people will come in early investors, the three Fs, the friends, families, fools, will come in very much being sold on blue sky potential.
100%.
So that it's always the blue
excitement.
Sky.
Yeah, yeah. It's excitement. That's
and then when you need more money and it moves into then, well, you're never going to bring in funds and institutions. And like I'll tell anyone, don't start there. Don't start with a venture capitalist. Don't start because you're wasting your time. But the next logical step is still high net wealths. It's just that network of high net wealths, people that have got a bit of spare cash that like the opportunity and still they will be sold on blue sky potential, right? Then the business is live and the real hurdles come in and then the focus becomes what is actually a robust financial model and how does it actually work. My preference is I like what I call a bottom-up analysis. So I'll go, show me what are all the like the cost inputs, what are all the drivers. I want to know that. Show me the market potential and I want to know what's a break-even scenario and can we fund that break-even scenario. Then I'll put my judgment around all the blue sky potential. But if I can see that the financial forecasts are showing that baseline can be covered, I'm excited.
And by baseline being covered, you just mean like cash positive. So not exactly. Profit, just it's not losing money on a monthly basis. Yeah.
So an example is I'm looking at, I had pitched to me a wonderful new medical garment that cures irritable bowel syndrome. And IBS is a huge global problem.
Oh my
so
God.
It's just like really
pain of my life.
Yeah. This is amazing, this product, right? And they showed me a financial model that showed, again, it was like we're going to sell this at $800 a unit. You know, we're going to sell 1,000 units right off the bat and it's just going to grow and grow and grow and grow. I'm not, that's just assuming they can have like a direct-to-consumer sales model. But the reality is you sell medical garments through a medical distribution system, right? It's having a Johnson & Johnson sales rep selling it to big pharmacies and hospitals. So, you know, what margin are they going to want on something that might sell for $800? They might say, hey, we're going to sell it for $400, but if we're going to sell this for you, we want you to fund our sales strategy, our promotions, and we want to make a 200% margin in it. So you keep coming back to the question I'm going like, how much can we make this for, right? I just wanted to know how much can you make it for? And you, today you can make it for $50. Now let's have a look at if we're producing 10,000 units, how much can you make it for? Okay, you can make it for $25. If you're going to make 100,000 units, you can make it for $15. All right, so that's the base case for me is thinking somewhere between $15 and $50 we can make this thing. And I'm thinking in the market potential, in a sales matrix of, you know, whether we can sell some at $800, we're going to sell some through a J&J sales rep at $60 net. What is it? And I'll kind of go, okay, do I think they can deliver these sales to recover the costs and we can break even cash-wise? And if I see that, because it's all about money, right? And these are some of the toughest capital markets we've ever been in at the moment. And it's so hard to raise money and you don't want to run out of money. So you rather ask for maybe a little bit less to deliver the base case, prove it, deliver on a milestone, win the confidence of your shareholders, raise some more money, and those same shareholders will be loyal to you. I give an example of the best investment I've made to date, right? And it's in a monopoly infrastructure asset. Right. I love the theme because I go, no competition, right? It's single asset, bang, right? Dominance, right? So I love it. I invested my own money at 8 cents to start with. Management said they were going to deliver on A, B, and C. They delivered on not only A, B, C, and D, C, they also delivered on D, which was a surprise to us. Then they said we need more capital and they priced it at 25 cents. I invested double my original investment at 25 cents. And then they said, we're going to deliver on milestone E, F, G and so on, right? They raised more money at 55 cents. I wrote another check at 55 cents. And beyond that, they raised more money at $1.50. And guess what? I have invested more money at $1.50 because at every stage, the business is becoming more valuable and every check I'm writing is less risky. So I'll see 100x on my first 8 cents, and I'm going to see, you know, maybe 5x on my last $1.50, which is still pretty compelling because the last $1.50 at 5x is a pretty good investment return given the risk profile's changed. So I think it's all about, you know, the journey and start conservatively, yeah, and build on it and build it and build on it.
Yeah. So I mean, if you're the business raising the capital, it really is about showing a lower risk profile. So, you know, I'll give my example for Boa, like what I did, because I really I was off. But so we raised, at first I raised 500 grand.
Yep.
From friends, all from friends and myself, but from friends, all club members and a couple of mentors. I started and then I realized, you know what? I didn't raise enough and I could have raised more. Like I had people wanting to give me money. So I said to those investors, I think there's like six of them, Laura, no? Yeah, there's like six investors. I went back to them. I said, hey guys, because I didn't want to ask them for more money because I was embarrassed. I said, guys, I'm going to go raise more money. And they said, no, we'll just give you more money. So I hadn't even done anything yet. They all doubled their money. So now I got $1 million, including me. I actually put more. But so then I had $1 million. I told them, okay, by the end, this is the start of last year. I said, by the end of, by this time, basically this year. So by the end of last year, we're going to be here and here. And where I am now, it's going to be funny to say, is where I wanted to be where I wanted to be at the start of last year.
Yep. You
know? Yep. So like now I've said to them, okay guys, now's the start.
Yep.
I was off by a whole year, even just to start.
Yep. Like three times the money and double the time.
Yeah. Right? I was way off. I mean, we're the most efficient startup of all time, so it's still the best investment ever and we're going to kick ass. But it just shows, like, it's kind of, it's describing what you were saying. I, in my head, said, well, yes, in theory, this is where I think I'm going to be and this is where I think I can be. But that's the blue sky thinking. What I really should have said was, wait a second, what are the things that are going to get in the way of me getting there? So what are the issues that are going to prevent me? Like you were using the case study of a sales force, and can you actually make the sales? And if you do plug into a company, they're going to take your money anyway. So for me, it was very much the product. It was like literally the app. It was like, I thought, yeah, it'll be ready by then. We've been building it for 3 months or 6 months, whatever it was at that time. And it's taken us a whole additional year to get it where we wanted it to be this time last year. And so now I have to say, well, taking your advice, I have to go, like I've met the investors this year and I've said, I learned my lesson. So I've given much lower targets to hit, even though I think I'm going to fucking smash them.
Yeah.
I gave them lower because I said, you know what, I do need to, if I say something, it needs to happen. So I gave lower targets to hit. We're going to hit those targets, hopefully. And then we're going to do a second raise. So then we're going to do like, I think you'd call it a seed round.
Yeah.
Probably. And hopefully we can say in the seed round, look what we've accomplished. We've got proof. After that seed round, we want to do then like a Series A.
Yep.
That's when we will go to VC companies because then we've got 2 or 3 years of evidence, like backed progress,
yep,
and hopefully some strong metrics and financials.
Well, the key thing here, right, and I've got a business partner that calls himself the chief anti-dilution officer, right? So it's all about dilution. The story I'm telling is think about a set of stairs and at every stair is a new valuation increment. So you want to be able to say, how can I raise a little bit of money that's actually going to defend the IP we're building, that's actually enhancing the product, that's actually meaningful and value accretive, and then raise some more money? Because you're just diluting a little bit of the upside. You're not diluting your foundation investment. So it's to have a strategy in the capital raise that's thinking about what's this look like in terms of dilution is the key thing. I have seen so many businesses where a founder ends up at a proper Series A raise. They started with 100% of the company and they've got 3%. and they're completely demotivated. So I think one of the big lessons in my story is going like maybe go a bit smaller and just make sure you are developing what is going to deliver that next stage of valuation arbitrage.
You know, raise less money, you're saying?
Look, it depends, mate. So I'll give an example, right? I'm working, a project, another Cub member I'm working with is a biotech, right? And it's probably one of the greatest, most proud things I'm involved with because of the social impact it makes. But, as a biotech, we need $100 million, right, to develop a therapeutic for the market. And I identified on day one that with $2 million, we could do particular tasks that would de-risk the investment. We did that. And guess what? We could then lift the valuation. We could raise a little bit more money. So we identified we could raise $2 million. We had an opportunity to go faster. We raised another one. Now we're starting a capital raise. It'll be $6 million to go through the next hurdle. And that's going to position us then for a $20 or $30 million raise on the back of it. So it's just all stepping stones along the way. But when I raise, right, we're sitting on a valuation today, let's call it $20 million, right? I know I need to raise $30 million next, right? So if I've got to, like, when I raise that $30 million and I don't want to give away more than 20 or 30% of the company, I've got to get the valuation up to $100 million. Right, if I want to have control of the destiny, to start with. So it's all about breaking it down and just delivering on those milestones, because you've got to push the valuation up as you're raising more money, right? And yeah.
Well, I really like the idea of step one, step two, step three, and you have money for each step. So it's not like give me money and I'm going to accomplish the goal with it. It's give me money so I can get to the next step. And, after two or three steps, then all of a sudden you have the proof in the pudding to go to people like yourself or big VCs or, other private equities and say, look, guys, we've got a proven track record of hitting our goals.
Yeah, it's more than the track record too, right? So I think a big part of this is transparency builds trust, right? And everyone will talk about a startup where – there's no communication and everyone's going, what's gone wrong, right? When you do that, typically something has gone wrong. And if you stop engaging with your shareholders, right, and there's a genuine problem, if you need more money from them, you're basically stuffed, right, because you've just lost that. So I think it's a big part of this is bringing people on the journey at the same time.
Completely agree. In fact, that's probably the only thing we got really right at NOAA. They're having fun. They're involved.
So, look, I have a look at, like a classic was there's a business I know during COVID and they were really focused on medical tourism. And you know when it was all going wrong and we're looking at it and no one thought this would have an impact, for 3 years the way it did, right? It was like, oh, it's going to be 3 months, it's going to be 6 months. And so the company just avoided the conversation, right? They just thought, oh, we'll get through this. They stopped talking to everyone. It would have been much better to have engaged with shareholders, right, to go like there's some really material investments by shareholders in this business to go on day one. We need to defend your asset, right? And we see this writing on the wall. It's really bad for the business. And we don't want to let it fail, but we're going to have to do some basic stuff just to defend the asset and save your investment, and we want your support for it. So it's not only delivering in the good times, but again, excuse the French, shit happens, right? Unpredictable events happen, right? I launched a business in the US a few years ago. We started launching it, was heavily debt funded and interest rates were zero. By the time we completed, right, our acquisition pipeline, interest rates were sitting at 4.75 and they went up to 5.5, right, plus all the premiums on top. So it almost destroyed the business model. So it does happen, right? You just never know, but you just can't stop communicating because people know, like people that have made money that are going to back you know from personal experience that things go wrong.
So what would then be the three most important things a founder should remember when raising capital? So communication, I kind of get the feeling, is number one.
Communication is really, really critical. I think is to have I'll just use the phrase milestones, right? What are key development milestones? And you just need to execute on them. And if there's a problem on executing on them, again, communicate it. But I think that's it. So that's two. What's a third?
Well, not really. Yeah. I mean, that's all you need if that's what you think is most important.
Yeah.
Because the simpler the better.
Especially, I think so. Yeah. Look, what a lot of founders do too, and this is the problem, mate. Is I'll always say I've stuffed on it because my greatest weakness is I'm too trusting of people. I've now got a really good radar to identify narcissists, and I don't want to work with narcissists. And you find that it is a personality type that a lot of founders are.
Yeah, right? It's a personality type that thrives in that role.
Yeah. It's the ADHD, it's the self-belief, it's the ego, it's everything about it. It's their baby, right? It's really difficult. But you know, I lost my point by concentrating on saying like.
Well, I actually want to focus on the narcissist thing. But I mean, we closed out talking about one of the most important things a founder should remember when raising and managing investors, which was communication and key development milestones and focusing on achieving them. Yep. But then you mentioned that you've also gotten very good at choosing the right person. So, I mean, why don't we focus on that? Why don't we focus on choosing the backing the right people? Because it's not just a business. Yeah. It's actually a person you're supporting. And what would you say is more important, the person or the business?
It's an equal balance, right? Because it's when you're talking the business, and again, I think in any business, right, I'm looking at what's unique in there, what's a unique selling proposition, what's intellectual property or something. So there's got to be something good there, and you may have a founder that's really, really critical to the preservation of that. But I think when it comes to the people, it's the most important thing is humility and empathy, right? So it's I know a lot of stuff, right? And quite often I am, you know, that doesn't sound humble to say, but quite often I am the smartest person in the room from the experience I've got at the table. But I'm doing a biotech. I'm not a scientist, right? So I'll be humble enough to go, if I go, here's a scientist with terrible business skills and they don't know what they're talking about in business. But the other way around, I'm going, I'm not a scientist, right? So I don't know this. So I think in a team, humility is key, where people all recognise that they don't know everything. And I'm a really big believer in team collaboration with the right skill set. So assembling a team with humble people that know they can respect other opinions and they're all adding value is really important. And empathy, right? So I have a look back at most projects I've worked on, and you know, things you move on and your relationships move on and so on. But like I'm launching a new business at the moment, another dental aggregation, and was just so wonderfully, you know, it was so humbling to be able to go and reach out to people in the UK, to people in the US, to people I've worked with here before, and every single one of them have said, Sean, if you're doing this business, I want to work with you. And they all want to work with me because, you know, I care for them. You know, I know all of their spouses' names, probably most of their pets' names. You know you're inspiring to them. And when you really need them to dig in and there's a problem, they'll walk into fire alongside you.
Well, I think what you're describing is more that you have a real relationship with these people.
Yeah.
And that's what I try to drill into people's heads, like a cup. You know, networking is like not network. Networking is about, it's not about loving everyone. It's about putting yourself in the positions or in a situation that's going to give you the opportunity to meet these special people that you are going to build strong relationships with. And very often those special people are two things. They're one, the most important one, is a good person. Yeah. Like you connect on a values level. You know, in your case, they're humble, they're empathetic, they're trusting, and you know, obviously good business people. But the second thing, because you can be a good person, that's fine. But the second thing is, are they valuable? as a person. And that's a weird one for people to say, because it's like, oh, if I'm not a valuable person, you're not going to be friends with me. But trust me, when you show that you are a valuable person, that you are working hard, that you are accomplishing something, people that are highly valuable people see you and they're like, wow, that person's kind of like me. Like, I used to be like that. And they back you. I reckon everyone that's ever backed me has backed me because, A, I became friends with them. Oh, I hope I'm a good person. I think I am. But B, they've looked at me like, oh, this person's got something. Like, oh, I want to be around for this journey. And so there's that twofold thing. And so when you're meeting these people, they would be seeing that in you, and you're obviously seeing that in them. And then it kind of opens a road, if you will, of like that we can drive down together. It's kind of like, okay, now we have the opportunity to be friends, because without those two things, we might not have that opportunity to actually connect.
They're the best ones, right? It's good. It's good
in terms of business relationships.
Yeah, I do. Like I think of a WhatsApp message I received last night where a co-founder of a business had me interview a new prospective CEO, right? And he says to me, I'm asking you this question because I love you like a brother, right? And you just gush. You just go like, this is someone I hugely respect that I think has had 10 times the career I've had. And for him to say that to me, just again, just it's the relationship. It's that, yeah, it's everything that goes with it that you just like, you probably pull something more out of yourself. And I think also your story there is when you're talking to peers around you, right? I mean, I was a pretty shy, nerdy young accountant back in the day. And for people to actually like pull that out of you and go like, trust yourself, back yourself, I think a lot of founders need that support around them, you know? So I think a good board really is helping people to sort of back themselves, right?
Prop
and take
them
that
up.
Risk, yeah.
Yeah, give them the confidence.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if they're not.
And particularly when you start raising other people's money, right? And, you know, like, again, that, I think that's what I was wanting to say about the narcissists, because they suddenly think that everyone that supported them, it's just other people's money, right? You know, and I still say, it's my company, but all that money that was put in, it's still my company and, like, they don't really matter. But, you know.
And also, I mean, the key markers of a narcissist is zero empathy and close to no humility.
Yeah.
So, you know, you really can... I mean, I've come across three narcissists in my entire life, and one of them was actually good. They all had businesses, all of them. So they were all entrepreneurs. One of them had a real business, like a really good business, who destroyed it because of relationship, because they just destroyed all the relationships around them, which narcissists do if you give them enough time. The other two were complete shit talkers. So when a normal person meets them, they think, wow, this person's really successful. They're really smart, you know, but when someone that knows better meets them, you know, very quickly the alarm bells go off like, wait, this isn't making sense. This isn't matching. Something's wrong here. And all of them I met were business or were entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I think that's why they're like that, right? Or they claim to be successful. That's funny. That's true.
Yeah, it's the hallmark of them. Yeah. So yeah, maybe then, you know, as a founder as a co-founder, whatever you are, raising capital, make sure that, you know, maybe even say your weaknesses, like show your humility. Say like, this is where I'm good and this is where I'm confident. This is where I'm not, and this is what I'm doing because of that, and this is what I'm concerned about. These are the risks, and I'd love your help on solving these. And that way, the people you're pitching to, or whether they already be investors, they're like, "Wow, this is someone who's honest, first of all, but also they've got a very true understanding of themselves, a very good understanding of themselves, and they're willing and able to, you know, overcome those challenges." And speak to us about them. Like, to me, that sounds like a winner.
Mm-hmm. And look, I think when you're telling that story, I'm also a really huge fan of advisory boards that are formally retained with a charter and there's incentive for them, right? So it's it's again, like as a founder, when you don't have that skill set, you might also have the skill set, but you're suffering from myopia, right? You're on your own Kool-Aid and going like, you know, Boa is the greatest app and, you know, I completely believe in it, but you're still not aware of where some disruption's coming on and so on. So I think, you know, the role of, you know, boards, but also advisory boards, is to be thinking in data sets that aren't part of your thinking, and trying to think about challenging you about the universe and maintaining that 30,000 foot view as well. But you're not going to get good advice when you're retaining people and asking them to be half pregnant. It just doesn't work, right? So you've got to, it's always about making it meaningful for people. And I think this is a big part of the belief and success for projects that I get in and back. Again, it's all about aligning long-term. I don't want to get a placement agent to raise me a little bit of capital because it's a transaction, right? And then they'll be gone, and you know, and if everything goes wrong, you know, it's all over. So it's again, if you're going to do that, and people are going to deliver something that's valuable to their business, and they've got, whether it's a share option plan, an ESOP, something like that, they've got a carried equity interest, becomes really valuable. You know, I give an example of. You know, a classic example when I'm looking at a dental aggregation, right? So I've did it in the US, you know, we raised over $100 million, got it up. It's, you know, it's going away. So it's a proud project to be behind, and I see the opportunity to do it again here. And I've now got, like, I'm putting together an advisory board of people that know innovative new products and services in dentistry in the US and in Europe. And also locally for some of the new innovators. And I want them to sit on the advisory board because I know that the local industry are going to have all this product bias, right? Most businesses hate change, right? They don't want to be under a change management program. So you need others to be challenging that and saying this is a threat to you or it's an opportunity. You know, like if I take dentistry, right, everyone here knows if you're talking dentistry, people have heard of things like Invisalign. And I'll just give an example, right? There is a far better technology that exists in the US, right? It's half the price. It's twice as good as what it is. But for the US party, it's too hard for them to come to Australia. They don't want to take the step of, in a small market, sending a sales force over here. I reached out to them with the help of my advisory board member in the US to go, how about we bring that product to Australia, we'll set up a new entity, and I want half of the upside from it, right? So I've completely de-risked it. So they can come into a new market, I'm going to underwrite it and I'll get half the upside. And, you know, that's a great, it's a great plan, it's a great model, but it's also, it has been evolved from having an advisory board member that's got their eye out on saying, hey, this is the latest and the greatest, you should be using it.
I also think with advisory boards, the really big obvious thing that I feel like not many people talk about is that it's essentially beefing up your network. Because when you have like 3 to 5 solid names, you know, behind your company and supporting you, all of a sudden when you're talking to people, and you're saying, oh, you know, Sean's on my board and this person's on my board. And they're like, oh, shit.
Credibility.
Yeah, it's credibility. And I feel like that's almost that's one of the biggest things an advisory board does. But one of the biggest benefits. But the other one is that, like, sometimes if you're a founder, well, you need to be accountable to someone, you know, or if you're a CEO. And having that accountability from an advisory board or a group of investors or whoever it may be, that accountability can make a big difference. And I actually think it can make you, like in my case, I felt like it made me become more conservative. So not in the sense of, over conservative, mm-hmm. but more in the sense of like, highlighting realism as well. So have the dream.
But you know, Daniel, I call it the 80-20 rule in reverse, right? So you as a founder, and most founders will go, they'll spend 20% of their effort and go, there's an 80% chance of a successful outcome here, right? So you want to go with your gut. right? You don't want a board and other stakeholders holding you back from that. What your board and the other stakeholders should be doing is encouraging you to take that risk. That's where you're going to create value, and they back solve it. So the last 20% that you're not good at, they'll spend 80% of their time solving it, and that's a good relationship.
100%. I also think that there's a lot of value in the founder being the dreamer, in the sense, having the blue sky. I think you need both. I think you need, you know, you need to believe that you are capable of achieving X, but you also need the ability to be a realist and be like, okay, what is the realistic outcomes and steps that are actually going to get me there? And it's very easy to say, you know, step one, start. Step two, $1 billion valuation.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot harder to see, okay, step one, start. Step two, step three, step four, step 2,567, $1 billion valuation. You know, like, it's harder to see that.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you that I think is important to have both. Like, I think you do need the confidence and the dream, but you also need the structure, the realistic thinking, and the understanding that it is possible. Like, my theory is always, it is possible and it is probable, in fact, but it doesn't mean it's going to be easy to do.
And I think you're articulating something that I see in 99% of startups and founder-driven businesses. You've got a clear North Star, right? You've got a vision. This is where I want to be. You know, this is what it's going to do. This is where we're going to be placed. And everyone that works with you will be aligned. You're all looking at the same dartboard. You're on that same journey. But, you know, another big part of it, right, that I see that where that doesn't work is family business, right? So there are a lot of people, you know, in the community that are involved in family business. And, you know, this is, again, back to the dysfunctionality of family, right? You have your vision, but, like, do family founders, do the matriarchs, the patriarchs articulate their vision of success and their direction to a family? They don't.
No, I agree. You know, anyone that's been around family money or families with a lot of money can tell you that it's very hard to keep a family together and keep everyone on track.
My dad never sat me down and said, son, here's my vision of success for the family. But it would be pretty good to hear that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I got married last year and we're obviously going to start trying to have a family, build a family. And I was thinking, I was like, so much that I've learned from Cub and from work is just going to so beautifully cross over, I feel, I think, into family. Like, I'll run it the same way. Like, I'll run both. Like, it's just leadership is what it is. And, you know, helping team members grow is, I mean, I view it almost the same as helping a kid grow. Like, obviously, going to try more for your kid because it's your kid, yeah. But
it's good. And it's a good theory until they stop listening to you, Daniel.
Oh, I will sort that. Yeah, you can't fire your kids, but I'll sort something out. But now we don't have too much longer. It went really fast, today's episode. But you mentioned before that right now is one of the toughest capital times you've ever experienced.
100%, yeah.
Why is that and what's that doing to the market?
Because public markets are still doing well. Right. So we've got, you know, so the easiest time I raised capital was after the GFC, because people just, they're in that mindset of watching live the volatility of a stock market where it just kept falling and falling and falling. And what, you know, we're at like seventh, you know, our stock market was like 7,000 points and it went down to a low of 3,300 in like March 2009. It was just shocking. And people just couldn't handle the volatility at looking at it with everything going down. Public markets are doing well at the moment. So you've got
at that moment.
Well, not
people couldn't.
So they just went like, if I took my money out of the stock market and I put it away in a private equity investment, right, for the next 5 years, and I it's like, if as long as the price goes up, that's okay, and maybe valuation's good because of the difficulty at that time. That was the problem. What we've got now is that public markets are doing so well. So the NASDAQ and Dow are hitting new records every day. So people are saying, I'm really happy to keep my money where I've got liquidity in public markets. So why would I give money to Daniel Faboa when it could be locked up for 5 years and I have to keep tipping money into it? That 5 years could become 10 years. you know, that's the problem. So I think that private equity in these unlisted investments always suffer when there are good alternatives.
That's really interesting. I never thought about it like that. And do you think that when the, like after the GFC, for example, most wealthy people I know end up making a fortune during or after a financial crisis because they got cash, they can start buying everything for really cheap, and normally properties, but anything really. And do you think so then they're like, oh, well, I'm actually I'm in a great financial position, so now I've got more spare cash to be investing into riskier businesses such as startups and other, you know, things private equity companies looking at.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it's just interesting, right? So I know that, like, again, a big metric, there's like most of the funds have big cash balances and they're sitting there charging 2% people to do nothing and not deploying, right? So it's a real problem in the market.
Because they're not spending the money, they're holding it.
They're not spending the money, they're holding it. But again, if you have a look at, you know, I digest every year. There's a great Camden UBS study. They interview 1,000 family offices globally that are over $1 billion, and they show exactly how they're investing. All those family offices, right, on an average, significantly outperform, like giving your money to a Morgan Stanley or a private bank or something, and they do really well. And they're upping their investments in alternatives. Right, so they're putting more money into private equity and private market assets. So, you know, the significant majority of their money is in the unlisted space. That's where they're making money, right? So we can see the smart guys, the big end of town, are doing that, and they're actually enjoying deploying capital at the moment because while it's tough, valuations have come right back down. So 2 years ago, I could have raised, you know, for a particular business, money, $2 million on a $10 million valuation, I could have put that to sleep in 3 months. Now it would take me twice as long to raise $1 million at a $5 million valuation. That's just the facts of the markets at the moment.
Right? It's funny because it's just always better to be the person with money.
Yeah.
No matter what, because let's say, like I was talking about this for our clubhouses, you got to negotiate these leases and, you know, you're basically at mercy to their terms, particularly if you love the space. And so we decided we're just going to buy all the future clubs in like Brisbane and Perth and Adelaide. And we're just going to buy the like boutique small buildings in the cities and we're doing it ourselves. But like even in the case you just described there, it's kind of like, well, the businesses who were operating in one way, which was, okay, we're easily able to raise a really big valuation so we can burn through our money really fast and spend a lot of money on, you know, be operating at a loss essentially and spend all our money on user acquisition even though we're losing more and more money. As soon as that system changes, then the business which needs money, is not the person with the money, the business needs the money, all of a sudden I say, oh my God, I have to change everything about my company. And you see it happen all the time because they fire thousands of people or whatever, but they change everything about their company. Like, oh my God, we can't now operate at a loss. We have to operate at least evenly or at a profit. Yeah. So fire 2,000 people, restructure the whole business. Like it's the business is constantly having to adapt to the given financial market. And well, so the moral of the story is having a lot of cash would be great. But
yeah.
but as a business, you've got to juggle that market. You know,
and that's where the successful families have the advantage because they have that long-term view and they just ride out those cycles. But, you know, when you're, you know, an entrepreneur and you're doing something and you've got like the milestones, the steps you're walking through and it you know, you run into these difficulties, it's panic stations, isn't it?
And you just got to, as the business, you've got to learn to live in the jungle. Like the jungle environment changes all the time, you know, whereas
Indeed.
When you're the investor or, you know, let's just say the investor in this case and you've got cash, well, you're not really in the jungle. You know, you're on a hut sitting high above it, just waiting for the right time to come down for whatever reason. You know, it's an interesting game.
Yeah,
I mean, I could talk to you for so do we have much longer, Laura? Or do I have to stop? 5 minutes? Well, I mean, I could, like I said, I could go on forever about the markets with you. And so do you think businesses right now is not a good time to be raising capital or?
I'm just going to say like it's tough. So this is again where I'm coming back to like just the defensive strategy of being a business and thinking about what I need to do in capital is maybe you can't be as aggressive with your priorities as maybe what you wanted to do. You know, that's not necessarily bad because it really focuses you on like what's essential, right? It's like what's essential, what I must do, what would be nice to have, what might be, you know, kind of like something fun to play with. So it really does focus you on the basics. Personally, I actually like it. I wish I had more cash, right? Because I'm seeing some really great business opportunities, and you know that the discussion around valuation and what's required is more equally balanced now. So I'm seeing that opportunity. It's just that, yeah, it's just the nervousness of others that think, well, if it goes wrong, you know, can the team execute? You know, what's it all going to mean? Is it going to be too hard for me to manage?
Yeah. So, I mean, for the business, it's like, well, you could raise capital, but you're going to raise it at a lower valuation. But for the investor, it's kind of like, well, now may be a really good time to invest because valuations are lower. However, the business could be at greater risk because we don't know what's upcoming with the economy. And there's a lot of global unrest and things like that.
Yeah, there is. And look, I mean, we talk about financial markets and people still are saying, right, at the moment they're going US elections.
Yeah, that's the big one.
And they're going, you know, there's war in Europe and they're going war in the Middle East. So that's a lot of negative sentiments in the market, right, that drives this as well. But I still think that, I back businesses where I see there's an ability to scale it globally. And it's getting technology and systems and the world shrinking that way ever more so, right? So, you know, I'm not a technology guy, but like I've been having some great fun with Microsoft Copilot in the last week. You know, like I've been using, if I'm thinking about what's a good business name, my starting point today is I'll throw ideas into ChatGPT. It's really easy to communicate with others in the market now about what is some partnerships and JVs that represent proper global scale and potential. So I think that it's really exciting for business, those sorts of ideas and concepts that you can run leaner, you know, more efficient businesses. And for a startup, it's wonderful because if you're a big corporate or a larger dominant competitor, and you've got your big bricks and mortar head office in Sydney and in Melbourne and in Manhattan and in London and that sort of thing, and you've got legacy IT systems and practice management systems, et cetera, you've got all this technology investment, you have to stick with it. You've got to recoup that investment, right? So the opportunity for the entrepreneurs is you can actually start it up more than any time in history and actually build collaboration and tools and know-how to launch with a very, very light base, a very, very light capital base. You don't need to, I mean, in the 80s, the first thing you had to do was like rent an office, right? And you'd be running investor meetings and asking people to come into your office. So I think the opportunity for business is like it's easier than ever for anyone starting something up.
Thank you so much for coming on today. To our listeners, if you want to find out some of Sean's biggest lessons, greatest lessons in business, biggest tips in business, favorite books, you can go to cub.club/podcast and get in contact with him there. If you want to catch up with Cub on social, it's at Club United Business. I can't even believe it took me this long to get you on the podcast. I should have had you a long, long time ago, although the later people come on, the bigger the audience is going to hear it. And I think this was a very special episode that a lot of people are going to get a lot of value from. So thank you. Thank you again, Sean.
My pleasure, Daniel. Enjoyed the chat.
Hope you enjoyed the show.